I'm guessing that Sarah Jaffe was pleased yesterday when two stories about political activism were featured prominently on the front page of the New York Times. One was about graduate teaching assistants winning the right to unionize. The other was about Native Americans in North Dakota gathering on horseback to block the construction of an oil pipeline. Ms. Jaffe argues in her book, Necessary Trouble, that the U.S. is in the midst of a new era of protests and activism, and points to the rise of the Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, the environmental justice movement, the fight for $15, and many other groups as evidence. Sarah Jaffe is an independent journalist whose work has appeared in The Nation, Salon, Washington Post. She's a reporting fellow at The Nation Institute and the co-host of Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast. Her book, which Carlos Lozada called necessary reading in his 9/12 Washington Post review, is published by Nation Books, and I'm very pleased that it has brought it to our show. Welcome.
I am so pleased to be here.
I should also add that last night, Bernie Sanders announced that he's formed Our Revolution, an organization to fight economic inequality and special interest groups. Could you have picked a better moment for your book to be published?
I know. Especially, I love that you mentioned those two news stories because I've been following, obviously, the developments with graduate student unionism forever. I was in a graduate workers union when I was in grad school, and I really kind of want to drop everything and go out to these pipeline blockades because they're fascinating. It really is. You know, when I was trying to sell this book, when I had written this book proposal that was about the revival of social movements, it was the summer of 2014, and people were kind of skeptical. I was not getting a lot of bites on it. And then, in the summer of 2014, the uprising in Ferguson began, and then suddenly people were a little bit more interested in what I had to say.
But the Sanders organization is already experiencing some difficulties.
Yeah.
Isn't a certain amount of disagreement to be expected in groups like the ones you're writing about?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think that the thing about the Sanders organization, we'll see what it turns out to be. But the really interesting thing to me that's come out of the Sanders campaign is both the growth in existing grassroots groups from like the Working Families Party, since we're here in New York, Democratic Socialists of America, and other grassroots organizing groups like one that I met in Illinois, the Will County Progressives that had formed out of this campaign. So I think watching people sort of in their communities organize is almost more interesting than what Sanders does with his list.
And many people talked about how there were certain similarities between concerns of the Tea Party and the Sanders people, even though they represented polar opposites, at least politically. Mm-hmm. There was some suggestion that that Donald Trump might pick up some Sanders supporters, although I suspect that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But still, there are certain impulses that seem to drive people, whether they're left or right.
Yeah, I mean, the beginning of the book, I start out with J.D. Meadows, who was a guest on Grit TV with Laura Flanders when I worked there back in 2010. And, you know, he had just joined not only the Tea Party, but the Council of Conservative Citizens, which is a group that gained a lot of fame a couple years ago when it turned out that Dylann Roof, who shot 9 people in a church in Charleston, South Carolina, had been reading their website and had found his, well, news is a strong way to put it. So this guy had joined not only the Tea Party, but like a really sort of rooted in organization, really rooted in white supremacy. And yet he's sitting here talking to me about how the Benchcraft plant has left and moved to China, how the banks got bailed out and the people in his community are struggling. And this is what drove him. And this is also what drove a lot of people who ended up at Occupy Wall Street.
You also spoke with a woman named Debbie Dooley in mm-hmm. Atlanta, a Republican who described herself as lifelong conservative, mm-hmm. and she considers herself part of the Tea Party even before it was called the Tea Party.
Yeah, I mean, Debbie Dooley is fascinating because she is both a very, you know, committed conservative and a founder of the Tea Party in Atlanta and involved in the national organization, and also the co-founder of something called the Green Tea Party, where she does work around environmental issues, and particularly she's a big advocate for solar power and distributed sort of energy ownership, so that for her, she likes the idea of being able to have her solar power panels on her own house.
Isn't solar power usually something associated with the left?
Exactly. But she finds it interesting. She doesn't like subsidies. The government gives a lot of subsidies to oil companies and gas companies and nuclear power.
And people who put solar panels on their roofs.
Exactly. But she thinks that people who put solar panels on their roof can control their own energy production, which is actually a similar argument to one I heard from activists in New York State. The people at Push Buffalo, which is a group in Buffalo, of course, who organize around this issue and really wanted what they call energy democracy.
Didn't the internet become an important tool for Dooley and other Tea Party groups in rallying supporters to disrupt town hall meetings that were held by the representatives?
Yeah, I think the internet is really one of the key features of the protest movements of the last 8 years or so, because the way we see them spreading, right, they spread virally across the country. They are replicated not by one leader who goes from city to city and starts a protest movement the way we often think about this, but by people who see it online. They see a tweet or a live stream and they start their own.
And populism has always been a part of the right and the left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's certly a very American tradition.
I'm speaking with Sarah Jaffe, who's written a book called Necessary Trouble, America in Revolt. It's published by Nation Books. This is WMIC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's talk about that title, Necessary Trouble.
Yes.
We're talking about troublemakers here?
We are talking about troublemakers. And, the title comes from something that Representative John Lewis, who, of course, before he was in Congress, was a leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And he said this. I interviewed him a couple years ago, and it happened to be during the same time as the Dream Defenders group was occupying the Florida State Capitol in protest that George Zimmerman had been acquitted for the murder of Trayvon Martin. And I asked him what his advice was for young people, and he said, basically, sometimes you got to find a way to get in the way and make some good trouble, some necessary trouble.
Social movements have historically been driven by young people.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess today would be the millennials.
Yeah.
But some of these groups seem to consist mostly of older people like the Tea Party.
Yeah, one of these things. I mean, the Tea Party, it's a very particular thing, right? It's almost a generational thing. One of the things that I found the most interesting when I sort of sat down and collected my notes to start writing was that in so many of these chapters and so many of these movements, I found a lot of people who were basically at or around retirement age, either people who had like Nancy Daniel in my the chapter on Occupy Homes. She was close to but not at retirement age. She wasn't able to get Social Security. She'd lost her job. And she worked in public relations, which she describes as, of course, a young person's field. So she's, in her late 50s, she's finding it hard to find work because they're hiring 25-year-olds just out of college. And, so I see a lot of people around her age coming back into these movements and really causing some trouble of their own.
You've identified the financial crisis of 2008 as a starting point for much of this mm-hmm. spurt of activism. What was it about that event that inspired so much outrage, and why that rather than any number of other recessions?
I mean, the financial crisis in 2008 was, first of all, it was just a lot bigger and scarier than most other recessions, certainly anything I've lived through. But more importantly, it was this kind of systemic crisis where you even watched the people in power, right? You watched the remnants of the Bush administration sort of scrambling around. And one minute they're telling us everything is going to be fine. The next minute, Henry Paulson is walking into Congress demanding $700 billion to bail out the banks. We saw, banks are collapsing. It really was this kind of, it was like the Great Depression in that way. And it really was, it shocked people into thinking that maybe this economic system we've been told is natural and good and the only way things are can actually collapse.
Didn't people you spoke with tell you that the financial crash and the government's willingness to bail out the big banks while allowing ordinary people to lose their homes had made them realize for the first time that our democracy no longer seemed to be working for them?
Yes. And, I think that we still underestimate how much anger there still is out there. And we see that, again, fueling both the Sanders campaign and the Trump campaign. These people are saying, why are you bailing out these people? And there is really a sense, again, I think on the left and the right, you hear it when Donald Trump is talking about crooked Hillary, right? He's talking about, he's trying to tie her to this corrupt elite, which, of course, he's also part of. To say that, you know, this government has always taken care of those people over there and it doesn't take care of you.
Well, I'm thinking of three major crises that led to activist times. Mm-hmm. One was the Depression.
Right.
Another one was the 60s.
Yeah.
But the 60s, the economy was booming.
Yeah, in the 60s.
It was just the Vietnam War that was causing that?
Well, it was the Vietnam War. It was a long sense of, frustrated promises, right? When we look at the civil rights movement and the black power struggles that came out of that. And I do think that that's different in that right now I'm hearing more people, you know, whose complaints, again, like the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, are not necessarily originally rooted in economic issues, coming around to say, like, actually, this whole economic system has been really bad for us.
Over the course of your reporting, didn't you come to believe that the various groups may have more in common than they even realize, what you call intersectionality?
Yeah. So
is that your term?
No, intersectionality is a term actually coined by law professor Kimberly Crenshaw, who is theorizing a way to explain the way that black women, for instance, experienced sexual harassment and things on the job. And so it's to say that, like, you are black and you are a woman, and so if you experience sexual harassment, the sexual harassment that you're experiencing is often going to be racialized. That if you are a woman who is Latina and who works at Walmart and makes $9 an hour, you're not experiencing those things as separate. You're experiencing all of these things overlapping at once, and they all shape your life and your position that you find yourself in society.
It's easy to imagine that there'd be overlap between groups like Black Lives Matter and the environmental justice movement. Mm-hmm. But how about between the Tea Party and the Bernie Sanders supporters?
I mean, I think that when you're talking about an election campaign, it's hard to have overlap because one group is supporting one candidate and one group is supporting another candidate. So, you know, I agree with you that I don't think we're going to see that many had been Bernie supporters supporting Donald Trump. I think,
or Tea Party people moving
right
over to Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to me to find out, though, if that had happened at all, if hearing Bernie Sanders' arguments actually convinced some people that maybe that was a better idea than what they had been arguing for.
But is all of this really at heart about people feeling that their voices are no longer being heard?
I think there are a lot of things, you know, that are contributing to this moment. I think that that's a huge one. I think also we're talking about, you know, people are not only feeling like their voices aren't being heard, they're also not able to pay the bills. They're also in danger of losing their house. They're also seeing their friends and neighbors shot and assaulted by police. Like, it's not just, you know, an abstract feeling that they're not being heard. They're actually materially suffering.
And then there have been some glaring inequalities between the rich and the poor, clearly visible after things like natural disasters like Hurricane
mm-hmm.
Katrina,
yeah.
Superstorm Sandy, also the man-made disaster of the BP Deepwater Horizon mm-hmm. explosion in the Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
People who suffered most were the people who couldn't afford to suffer most.
Right, right, exactly. And, you know, I lived in New Orleans. I went to college down there, actually. And I was gone by the time Katrina hit. But I just remember watching and being glued to the news and going, I know those neighborhoods. I know those. And, you know, there was a rumor when I was there, because I was there, there was an almost hurricane. And there was a rumor that they had actually, the city had rigged certain spots on the levees to blow if there was a flood to relieve the pressure, and that those were in the Ninth Ward. Now, that's not true, but it
and what was the,
almost
the
reflected the reality.
To force black people out?
Just because that was who lived there, and that was the less important part of the city, that you couldn't have flooding in the French Quarter because that's the driver of the entire economy of New Orleans. And so, you know, again, it's sort of a conspiracy theories often reflect some sort of reality, right? People are attempting to explain the way they live.
To some degree, wasn't that borne out after Katrina was over, mm-hmm. and certain areas that really weren't affected still were treated as though they were affected.
Yeah.
There was a housing mm-hmm. project in the middle yeah. of New Orleans that was knocked down.
Yeah.
People weren't allowed to go back even though there hadn't yep. been any flooding there. And now that has become prime property in
yeah.
New Orleans.
Yeah, I lived not far from actually where that those housing projects were, and they were nice. They were lower rise. I was actually just talking about this the other day. And right, and they were nice, and so they're gone. Also, you know, the New Orleans public schools are now entirely charter schools, and thousands of teachers were laid off. And again, those were teachers who were majority Black women.
My guest is Sarah Jaffe. She has written a book called Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. It's published by Nation Books, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Sarah Jaffe, who is a Nation Institute fellow, independent journalist, also the co-host of the Dissent magazine Belabored podcast. So you're doing your own radio.
I am.
Are you covering stories like the ones in this book, Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt, which is published by Nation Books?
Yes, I am. Every week, or every other week, excuse me.
There are so many stories that come along even after this book is published. For example,
yeah.
just yesterday when the drug company Mylan, I guess it is,
yeah.
announced that it was raising the price of EpiPens by 500%, it was revealed that executive salaries at the company had gone up 600%.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of thing that fuels people's outrage.
Yeah.
Are people surprised that the CEO's father is Senator Joe Manchin, who's a Democrat from West Virginia?
I mean, I don't think so, because I think the lack of faith that people have in Congress, I like to joke about how Congress is less popular than witches, cockroaches, and Nickelback. That's not partisan, right? People also think that Democrats are not treating them right.
Some of these movements have been criticized for being leaderless.
Mm-hmm.
Did that lack of a clear leader present a challenge for you when you were trying to decide whom to interview?
Yes and no. It actually ended up being an interesting theme of the book because I dug into the Moral Mondays movement also, which has much more of a you know, traditional leader in Reverend Barber. But yeah, in some of these cases, I sought out people who had been sort of in the news and been, you know, well covered, I guess. In other cases, I really made an effort to talk to people whose stories had not gotten out there at all. And try to balance that out so I'm actually getting the story people think they already know and balancing it with some different stories that they don't already know.
You prefer to describe those group structures as horizontal rather mm-hmm. than leaderless. Is that your term?
No, that is also not my term. Mm. That is a term that comes out of the movements in particular. And yeah, so horizontal is... I like that term because it describes, again, sort of the way they spread as well as anything else. So when I'm talking about these movements spreading virally, they're spreading without a particular leader having to kick them off and give them permission to get started.
On the other hand, Occupy Wall Street was criticized to some degree because it didn't have anybody to say, okay, you're wasting an awful lot of time talking about this ridiculous thing. Let's get back yeah. to the, you know, let's get back to serious stuff.
Yeah.
Everybody was equal, and sometimes that I know just as a talk show host having to handle some calls or
yeah.
Emails,
yeah.
not everybody has as interesting things to say as others.
Well, it's not even that they're interesting or not interesting. I mean, first of all, you had the problem of some people deliberately coming down to just cause trouble and not really participate in anything in a constructive way. On another hand, these are kind of experiments, right? And the Occupy one, I think most of the movements that have come after that have moved away from the kind of 100% consensus process where you're trying to get a couple hundred or even a couple thousand people to agree on something, which is just like next to impossible.
And is it your contention that groups like Occupy Wall Street or Black Lives Matter deliberately didn't create hierarchical organizations for the groups partly because they were unhappy with how unresponsive the country's current leadership is?
I think that that's a real part of it. I think there's also a real understanding that, you know, when I was in St. Louis and I was talking to the young people who are taking part in the Ferguson protests, I spoke with Kennard Williams, who's one of the young people who's in the book, and he said to me, and I really, you know, it really sort of hit me in the gut, he's like, one leader can get killed. And when we're talking about a movement that had risen up in response to a young black man being killed by police and the police facing no consequences whatsoever, that's not an idle fear. That's not paranoid. That's reality, and that's the reality they live. And so
Martin Luther King, for example.
Right, exactly. And so, yeah, so for them to think about that, it's both really sobering, right, that these are people who are like 21, 22 years old thinking about that, and also it affects the way that they structure their movement.
Alicia Garza, an activist with Black Lives Movement, told you that the movement is leaderful, not leaderless.
Yeah, and that term is one I like as well. Because it means that anybody can take the lead on something. And again, in St. Louis, I found that a lot of the protesters were forming little groups, right? They, you know, the old school activists would call them affinity groups almost. And they were, in some cases, like actual organizations with structure, in some cases, just kind of loose groups of friends who gave themselves a name. But in that case, you would have one group that had one action going on and another group having another action going on, and some would come and support each other. I was there, you know, this one weekend, and the Millennial Activists United, one of these groups, had Black Brunch, where they go and they protest outside of brunch in sort of affluent white communities and ask these people to take responsibility for what's going on in their city. Another group had something they called Monday Morning, where they went to the mayor of Ferguson's house at, I believe, like 5 a.m. on Monday morning and woke him up and brought him coffee and asked him to resign.
Which he didn't do.
He did not do, no.
You've said that you were personally changed by writing this book. In what way?
I mean, there are many, many ways. One of them is practical, which is that I get to write about this stuff now as a job and got to write a book about it that, you know, 5 years ago, it was really hard for me to sell labor stories as a freelance journalist. It was really hard for me to convince editors that this was a thing worth covering, and that began to change with Wisconsin, and it really changed with the Fight for 15.
You write that it was significant that protesters took over public spaces during the Occupy movement in New York and other cities, and during protests in Wisconsin at the Wisconsin Capitol building in 2011, the protests against Governor Scott Walker's bid to end employee unions' rights, collective bargaining.
Yeah.
Why is that significant? And how is it significant in the light of the fact that Scott Walker wound up surviving that and remains, in some people's eyes, a rather popular governor in Wisconsin?
Well, at least his presidential campaign didn't
work. He was reelected.
He survived a recall attempt, and he was reelected. And, you know, I think that this is one of the questions that these movements are really grappling with now, is how to deal with electoral politics, which, again, like, we saw some of this energy go into the Bernie Sanders campaign. We saw some of it very deliberately stay outside of the Bernie Sanders campaign, right? We saw protesters from Black Lives Matter groups protesting Bernie Sanders. But also, you know, we're seeing this, again, the occupation of public space recurring. There are people who are in City Hall Plaza, I believe, still today. I did not go there before I came here to check, but they have been there since August 1st. There's a group that have taken over what they're calling Freedom Square in Chicago. And again, they're holding space, and they're sort of creating these mini societies in that space, right? So in that space, they have medics, they have free food, they have free books. They have things that are actually kind of hard to come by out in the real world.
People did wonder why Black Lives Matter activists criticized Bernie Sanders. After all, aren't groups more effective when they develop allies? And the Sanders people would have been natural allies.
I think politicians are most effective when they're pushed, no matter who they are. You can see somebody like our Governor Andrew Cuomo, who, you know, for years opposed raising the minimum wage past a, you know, very sort of token increase, suddenly come around to $15 an hour for at least a big chunk of New York State. That has been true everywhere. And when you agree that you're not going to criticize a politician because they are your ally, what happens when they do you wrong? What do you do? So I think that, you know, and again, that these movements in this moment recognize that and have a, I think, healthy distrust of all politicians, I think is a pretty good sign, actually.
One of the groups that has a certain hierarchical structure is Moral Mondays.
Yeah.
You mentioned that earlier. You talked to Barbara Smalley McMahon, who's an ordained American Baptist minister in Raleigh, North Carolina. What did she tell you about why she got involved?
You know, she was such a fascinating person. I have many favorites in this book, but she was definitely one of them. And, you know, she was a person who had been a minister, but she had been a pastoral counselor for most of her career. So she had been, you know, working with people one-on-one. She didn't like getting in the pulpit. She didn't like a lot of attention. And at some point, you know, this government of North Carolina, the elected state assembly, started just rolling out law after law. They were cutting funds for public schools. They were slashing Medicaid. They were cutting everything, including attacking voting rights. And at some point, she, like many other people, had kind of just had enough. And so she kind of stumbled into her first civil disobedience and was like, well, I guess I'm going to do it. And now she loves it and has been, she went to St. Louis for Moral Mondays in Ferguson on the 1 year anniversary of Michael Brown's death. She really felt that she connected with the young people there and really learned something about what she called theology of disobedience.
Some people feel that voting is the most effective way to get what you want done. Others feel that your vote really doesn't count. But there's been a lot of pressure. There have been serious attempts to get more people registered to vote, yeah. Although there's also been laws, the courts are striking a few of them yeah. down, to prevent people right. from voting.
Yeah, I think that voting is a basic and fundamental right. And when we see the attacks on it that came in places like North Carolina, you see what, you know, why that's so important. At the same time, again, I think politicians are most effective when they're pushed and they're most effective. You know, we got the New Deal not because Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a nice guy, but because there was a Communist Party to his left organizing people, and he figured we have to do something here to actually make the majority of people's lives better in this moment.
They co-opted many of the Socialist Party's mm-hmm. policies,
yeah,
proposals.
Yeah. Yep, and Huey Long, who was coming from a, you know, populist place too. And so, right, I think it's wonderful if politicians want to start co-opting these ideas, like I mentioned again, Andrew Cuomo going for, you know, $15 an hour after avoiding it. But again, I think that what we're seeing in this moment is voting is not enough for most people. Many of them will still vote. Many of them still, you know, got involved with presidential campaigns. But many of them think that that's not going to cut it. It's going to take a lot more than that to make the change that we need.
Judging from some of the mail I've received, people who were supporting Bernie Sanders mm-hmm. felt kind of disillusioned when they felt he didn't really have a chance. But would he have had a chance? Wasn't it just a matter of pushing certain policies?
I mean, I'm a little...
Well, in the end, I think many people felt that Bernie Sanders really didn't have much of a chance of getting the nomination, but it was important that he speak about all sorts of issues that maybe would have forced Hillary Clinton to consider things mm-hmm. she wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah, I think, you know, when Bernie Sanders got into this election, I thought he would get like 10-15% of the vote. He got over 12 million votes across this country. This is a, you know, a guy who calls himself a socialist. That is a huge shift in Americans and how we think about politics. And it was much more than I expected him to get, certainly. And so it was interesting. There seems to be sort of people like me who are like, wow, this is, I totally didn't expect this to be that good. And people who really are really still sort of recovering from the loss. And like, losses are hard. When you put your heart and soul into organizing something, whether it be a union drive or a presidential campaign or any other kind of movement, that is hard. You have to take some time to sort of take care of yourself and come down from that. But I think that we'll see those people get back up and get involved in something else soon.
You've written that the next challenge for the movements will be creating organizations that last and that suit the needs of 21st century troublemakers, that can be flexible and still enduring, that can overlap and connect up with one another and create more long-term plans for the future they want to see.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think since this, since the book went to print, of course, you get a little bit of a gap time between that and when it comes out. I'm really impressed with the longevity and the tactical innovation of some of the groups that, again, came out of the Black Lives Matter movement, the Black Lives Matter Network itself. There's group BYP 100, the Dream Defenders. And these are organizations that now have been around, you know, since 2013.
Is climate change one of those intersectional issues?
I think I wrote in the book that climate change is the ultimate intersectional issue.
But it seems to often be overlooked, for example, in both the Democratic and the Republican primary debates. It barely came up.
Yeah.
Was that the fault of the moderators?
Well, I think that there's a tendency, right, within primary debates to avoid things that you think that the candidates agree on, which is, and I think that's probably wrongheaded because it's interesting to tease out the differences there. But in that case, that doesn't even make sense because there were very real differences, right? Hillary Clinton was saying that we should, you know, that fracking is for natural gas, which is a huge contentious issue in the environmental movement, was a huge contentious issue in New York State, was still sort of supporting that. And so when we're talking about climate change, we have to do more at this point than say, okay, well, these two candidates agree that climate change is real, and these candidates over here all think that it's a lie. You have to actually talk about what are we going to do about it.
And fracking seems to be another one of those issues that has influenced Andrew Cuomo. He seemed to be inclined to accept it until he discovered that so much of the Democratic base was opposed.
Yeah, it was fascinating to talk to some of the people from, Binghamton area in New York who just really, they were literally, this one woman could see the flares on the fracking wells in Pennsylvania from her house. And they really just dogged Cuomo over and over and over again. Everywhere he went, they would show up and protest and say, no fracking, New York. And, the market shifted a little bit on this stuff, too, which is important to take into account. But he really felt a lot of actual pressure on that I think was instrumental in making him change his mind.
Sarah Jaffe will be speaking with New York City activists Nalini Stamp, Mary Clinton, and Nastaran Mohit tonight at 7 o'clock at Housing Works, which is at 126 Crosby Street. Her book, Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt, is published by Nation Books, and I thank you so much for coming by to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me.